Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Frank Delaney is with us again this year. We speak with Frank about once a year, and it's always an absolute delight. Frank has been called by Scott Simon of NPR the most eloquent man in the world. What a wonderful description of a human being. He's the author of books, many books. I'm sure you're familiar with many of his historical novels, including Ireland, a novel, Tipperary, Shannon. He's also author of The Last Storyteller, Venetia and Kelly's Traveling Show, and The Matchmaker of Kenmare, Simple Courage. Frank was a broadcaster for BBC for a number of years, and he interviewed some 3,500 writers from all over the world. He has done a number of documentaries on the world's great writers, particularly Irish great writers. He was born and raised in County Tipperary and now lives in the United States. The thing that he's done that is really quite remarkable is he has this mini podcast. It's a weekly essay that takes everybody through Ulysses, because Ulysses is one of those books that you want somebody to help you go through it so that you can understand all of it. Frank is with us this St. Patrick's Day week. Not quite St. Patrick's Day, but the day that he could join us, and we're delighted he could. We'll welcome phone calls for him as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Frank, how have you been?
So long. So short a year.
It does seem like a short year, doesn't it?
Extraordinary how time flies. It really does.
I know.
And I don't feel any older. I don't know if you do, Kathleen.
I don't, actually. But I know I am, Frank. I know I am.
I refuse to accept that I am. I'm just going to be a thing of beauty and a boy forever.
And the most eloquent man in the world as well.
Oh, dear. One day I will catch up with Scott Simon and he will pay for that, I can tell you.
Don't you love that description, though? I mean, and it puts the pressure on you, but what a lovely description of that.
Scott's mischievous compliment, and it's absolutely delightful until you stand up to speak at dinner or in a library or somewhere like that, and somebody introduces you as the world's most eloquent man. Long ago, Kathleen, I did an interview in Ireland with a man who had just been elected as the mayor of Blarney. So I drove down from Dublin to see him, 120 miles to see him, and I was interviewing him, and he had a sidekick, and I was interviewing him in a pub. So I said to him, "So, you've just been elected the mayor of Blarney. Is that right?" And he nodded. I said, "What does the mayor of Blarney have to do?" And he just held out his hands and shook his head. I don't know gesture. So five more questions, not a word.
Oh.
And of course, the whole thing was a joke. He was chosen for his lack of eloquence.
That put you on the spot.
Absolutely. It was very, very funny. It was a very, very good joke, and it worked very well.
That's very funny. Let's talk. You know, I don't think I've ever talked to you about just a few of these. 3,500 interviews with writers, Frank, is a lot of interviews of writers. What an incredible thing to have done, isn't it?
It was a kind of university.
Sure it was.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It was a kind of university, and it was. I had a book show that ran on BBC Radio in London. Radio in Britain, as you probably know, Kathleen, being a broadcaster yourself, is a very different deal from radio here.
Mm-hmm.
It's hugely important. It's got a major place in the culture. It's what television, what network television here used to be like before cable came along and eroded all that audience. And every week I did this show called Bookshelf. It was a half-hour show, and every week we featured an author of one kind or another. And we got most of the greats of our time. I interviewed John Updike, interviewed Richard Adams, who wrote Watership Down. You name them, Margaret Atwood, Marilyn French, they were all over the place, every single one. Some were movie stars who had written autobiographies, like Kirk Douglas, who was charming. The most interesting one of them all is going to surprise you. The most interesting writer I ever interviewed is going to astound you.
Okay, who was it? Who was it?
Because he came in to be interviewed very briefly.
Huh.
The producer I had that week was something of a literary snob and said, "Well, let's give him 10 minutes. We've got a 10-minute slot this afternoon for you in the studio." And I said, "Sure." But I checked and found out that there was nobody booked behind us in the studio. So I thought if there was a chance. Now, this man came in wearing a white raincoat and smoking a cigarette, and he smoked all through the interview. And he was a man called Ed McBain. He wrote a series of thrillers under the name Evan Hunter. Mm-hmm. He wrote The Blackboard Jungle.
Hmm.
He wrote the famous 57th Precinct novels in New York. And he proceeded to give us a masterclass. He'd written something like 200-300 novels.
Oh.
A masterclass on the structure of storytelling.
Oh.
Referring back to Shakespeare all the time.
Oh.
He wrote the screenplay of The Birds for Alfred Hitchcock. He did a huge amount of work. And he was a major figure. But I had known him since I was an early teenager. I had discovered these novels of New York. The hero was a policeman called Steve Carella, who had a beautiful blind wife who was always in some kind of jeopardy or another from the bad guys. And I knew that this guy was an ace storyteller. He was spellbinding. And do you know those occasions when somebody is in your studio, Catherine,
sure,
and the word goes out?
Yes.
The word spreads up and down, and people gather?
Yes.
In the control room of the studio to
mm-hmm,
listen?
Mm-hmm.
That happened that afternoon.
Oh, and it, totally unexpectedly.
Totally unexpectedly. He disarmed everybody, and he proceeded to show us how Shakespeare told stories.
Oh.
Dividing plays into three-act plays and five-act plays. He showed us how Othello was the model on which much of Hollywood's screenwriting was based, and how Noel Coward taught so much of Hollywood how to write screenplays. It was absolutely fascinating. So, what do you learn in those circumstances? You learn how to begin to become a writer.
Hmm. And what did that literary snob say to you after that interview was over?
I had a good time with that.
I'll bet you did.
I had a good time with that. You know the phrase, to rub it in? That's what that was like.
Well, a lot of your books, too, your books are about storytellers. The Last Storyteller is the name of one of your books, and it certainly is an Irish tradition, the tradition of telling marvelous stories.
You know what's just begun to happen? I've just been tracking it through management circles. Businesses are beginning to understand the power of story in cutting deals, particularly in takeover bids and in transfers of power and things like that. They understand that the telling of the company's story is important. You tell, this is what this company does, this is what this company is going to do, and you tell it in the form of a story. Because the moment, as you know, somebody starts to tell you a story, you have them hooked.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the best democratic communication we have. Everybody has a story, and everybody has the power to tell a story. And that's what I love about it.
I've noticed just in my lifetime, which is getting to be pretty lengthy at this point in time, but I think of the number of presidents, probably starting with Ronald Reagan, who would fill the galleries during the State of the Union speeches with people who had stories that were dramatic. And by golly, every president has done it since then. I was really struck by the 102-year-old woman who had problems voting when President Obama gave his State of the Union. What a story that is. It was filled with stories. There are stories in the gallery. And I think we all look forward to hearing those.
And don't we elect our presidents here in the United States on the basis of who has a great story?
Yes, we
do. Was there
yes.
a better story than the Obama story?
No. No.
The Reagan story was a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
The Jimmy Carter story, a peanut farmer from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
These are great stories, and we tend to want to go with the narrative because we understand the story. We can relate it to ourselves. It's part of our lives. We know the people in the story by the time the story is finished, and we can make up our minds whether to trust them or not. The power of narrative is the power of sharing. It is not the power of handing down like a diktat or some kind of proclamation. It is drawing the voter in politics into the story with you and enabling them to get alongside you and feel they're part of the same story.
Mm.
And President Obama, in his first campaign, made his story part of America's story. And so many people got alongside him and voted for him.
Yes, they did. And tell me about the Irish tradition when it comes to storytelling and how you've woven that into your novels, Frank.
The Irish tradition is, to my mind, one of the more interesting ones. For a start, the early Irish tradition of storytelling was, in a sense, supported aristocratically because every castle, every chieftain, and this was a sophisticated society ever before Christ was born, Ireland was a sophisticated society. They had their own storytellers, just like the Greeks had their storytellers, just like the Africans had their storytellers. But in Ireland, the storyteller was often resident in the house of the king or the chieftain. And at night, at the banquet, or once a week, or whatever, he would entertain them. And very often, He was also the record keeper in that the story he told was the story of the family, or the story of the great honored guest who was at dinner that night, mm-hmm. who was at the feast that night. Mm. Now, fast forward about 10 centuries from that tradition into the darker ages in Ireland, high medieval times, the 1500s, the 1600s, when the first of the Elizabethan genocides, or attempted genocides, began to happen in Ireland, when the language was outlawed, when education was outlawed, when to be a Catholic was a dangerous thing, when a priest or a teacher could be shot at sight, when it was a crime to own a book. The story of the country went underground. Hmm. People had no entertainment. Mm-hmm. So they sat at their firesides in their hovels made of mud, and they had stories to tell. And not only did they have stories to tell, in some cases, those stories weren't just inventions, recent inventions. When St. Patrick came to Ireland, he brought with him a retinue of monks, priests, ordained men, who had Latin and who had Greek and who could read and who could write. And they taught the Irish men whom they ordained as monks and priests to read and write. And those men, when not transcribing the Psalms or the prayer books and making illuminated books in the monasteries to sell or loan to other monasteries, they wrote down the legends they had heard in their own families as children. And so they were preserved. So were the great stories of Ireland preserved, as well as records of who owns what land in the area, mm-hmm. how many acres of whatever land measurement was in use at the time. So there was a tradition all the time of the country telling itself its own narrative. Because finally, in the 1600s and 1700s, that was all it had. And then along in the 1800s, 1900s, when politics freed up, along came people like William Butler Yeats and turned those stories into poetry and made Ireland proud of them again.
Oh, I love Yeats.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's wonderful. I have, it brings to mind, I have this dinner party every year on just about on St. Patrick's Day, and the only requirement, the guests always say, what can I bring? And I say, well, if you want your own Irish poem, why don't you pick a poem? And then I make everybody read a poem. And for me, it's always been Yeats, and for our son, it's always Seamus Heaney. And I'm wondering, for you, are there poets that completely absorb you, that you read all the time? I know you're such a literary guy. You're not a literary snob, but you're a literary guy, so you misread many. But are there some we should pay close attention to?
Yeats without question. Right. And his lines run through my head the whole time. You mm-hmm. mentioned reading a poem there for St. Patrick's Day. And as you were saying it, I could see running across my head like the words on a screen. O'Driscoll drove with a song, the wild duck and the drake. From, do you know that poem, The Host of the Air?
Yeah. Do you have it? Do you have poetry with you? No?
I could probably reach across the office and grab a poetry book.
Yeah, why don't you, when we take a little pause? Because it would
Absolutely.
Be lovely to hear you read some things.
But they're wonderful. Heaney is just essential.
I'm glad to hear you say that.
It's
I think
essential.
So, too.
Uh-huh. There is a book, this is for everybody. There is a book of poems by Heaney called The Haw Lantern, H-A-W. Based on the fact that the hawberry looks like a little red lamp on the bush. And in that, there is a collection of poems called The Clearances. It's a series of 6 short poems, and it's about the death of his mother. They are totally accessible. One of the poems is about peeling potatoes with her. One of the poems is about folding the sheets with her after they've been out drying in the line or putting them out to dry. They are the best poems on bereavement ever written. And every person who's listening to us today can read them. They're not out of anybody's reach. They are the ultimate in the democratization of emotion through literature.
Mm-hmm. I hope we're not neglecting poetry, Frank. It's just, last night I was just listening to poems after poem after poem, and we'll play some of them this hour. By golly, it's just such, it's so important to understand the human experience and to have your emotions take some kind of form, so they're in a bigger context, and you can work through them in some ways. It's you do it through poetry.
Well, cheer up, because do you have any idea of the amount of poetry there is on the internet?
Is it? Well, I go to
huge.
The internet every. Is it huge?
Huge, absolutely. Mm. You can find almost any poem or poet you ever heard of on the internet.
Oh, that's good.
And some of the poetry sites, like for example, out of Chicago, the Poetry Foundation. Which is just a wonderfully run organization.
Oh.
Wonderfully run.
Oh.
Their website is one of the best, for me, one of the best websites on the internet.
Really? The Poetry Foundation out of Chicago. We'll have to talk to them.
Poetry Foundation in Chicago is run by a wonderful man called John Barr. They had a legacy from somebody, a rather large legacy, and they have used it so well. Everything they do has got a real touch of class about it. It's a very classy website. It's a forum for that ranges from the most serious and thoughtful of the literary and esoteric to the most accessible and democratic of poets.
Oh, thank you, Frank, for the suggestion. How's the mini podcast of Ulysses coming along, sir?
Well, we started it in, June 2010? Mm-hmm. And we're heading for 750,000 downloads.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you believe that?
That's wonderful.
People are very engaged. I hear about it from somebody every day of my life, and sometimes several times a day by way of email. And I had an email the other day from somebody in China saying, you have no idea what this means to me in Chengdu, wherever Chengdu is. And people are very engaged. And what I'm discovering is, which is wonderful, is that people, for example, will have lunch at their desk on a Wednesday. We put it up on a Wednesday morning at 1 o'clock in the morning. And they will open a copy of Ulysses. And they'll join me. That podcast that week at that piece of text, and they'll read the piece of text as I'm explaining it. And they are enjoying the experience enormously. I can tell you something, Kathleen, however much they're enjoying it, they're not enjoying it nearly as much as I am.
Oh, I'm so glad you're doing this.
It's the best thing. I have such fun with it. Mm. And it is a university in itself. You learn so much. I think it was the week before last, the piece of text that I broadcast about was 11 words long. And that was a 10-minute broadcast. Mm. There were so many references in there. Mm-hmm. Hidden, buried away. In a word, maybe, there would be 5 references.
That's why we need you to guide us through.
Oh, it's just such fun.
I'm so glad. Frank Delaney is our guest. We talk to Frank. We should talk to Frank more often than we do, but we always talk to him on St. Patrick's Day. It's time to broaden our interviews with him. Frank is such a literary man. He, as you heard him say, worked for the BBC for a number of years doing interviews, 3,500 interviews with many, many different authors on the bookshelf program. He is a prolific author himself. He's written a number of historical novels, The Last Storyteller, Venetia Kelly's traveling show, Tipperary, the novel Ireland, a big bestseller, The Matchmaker of Ken Mayer, Shannon, a novel, Simple Courage. He did a series of documentaries on Robert Frost, Hemingway, Mailer, Matisse, Van Gogh, Oscar Wilde, Joyce, Shaw, Emily Dickinson, and many others. And he's our guest. He joins us once a year, long about St. Patrick's Day. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. The Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And if you want to leave us an Irish poem on the Facebook page, that would be great. And Frank is going to go to the other side of the room and get his book of poetry. And we have a little poetry on tape here, too. So we'll listen to music and hear some poems and have a good time. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Before we start taking phone calls, I think that Frank's comments about Seamus Heaney, that he was essential, had me thinking that we simply must hear a little bit of Seamus Heaney. This is the poem, The Rain Stick. And Frank will read us poetry as well. But here's a poem for you.
Upend the rain stick, and what happens next is a music that you never would have known to listen for. In a cactus stalk, downpour, sluice rush, spillage and backwash come flowing through. You stand there like a pipe being played by water. You shake it again, lightly, and diminuendo runs through all its scales like a gutter stopping trickling. And now here comes a sprinkle of drops out of the freshened leaves, then subtle little wet soft grass and daisies, then glitter drizzle, almost breaths of air. Upend the stick again, what happens next is undiminished for having happened once, twice, 10,000 times before. Who cares if all the music that transpires is the fall of grit or dry seeds through a cactus? You are like a rich man entering heaven through the ear of a raindrop. Listen now again.
Let's go to phone calls for the most eloquent man in the world, Frank Delaney, Eugene, and Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I was born with a good Irish name. I got in line at the right time. Can I give the name?
Sure.
I was born Eugene O'Toole.
Ah.
And I run a shoeshine stand during the summer months at Civil War events, and I have polished a lot of tennis shoes, not because the tennis shoes can be polished or they need polishing, just because I can tell a good story. And that just pays off pretty much. I can put the flourishes in. It may not be the truth, but it's a good story.
Maybe we should teach that in the school, Frank, how to tell a good story, huh?
Well, if you listen to a kid in school, at a show and tell or something like that?
Yes.
You can pick out the star very quickly. You can pick out the person who's going to do well, because that's somebody who knows instinctively at that age how to use personality.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells a good story, and if he tells a good story, he's going to go far.
How true. Eugene, how will you celebrate St. Patrick's Day?
I'm still in bed, sleeping.
Well, I think that's a good Irish tradition.
Yeah, you got to take a nap every now and then.
Absolutely.
Or sleep in every now and then. Frank, what have you been up to during the last year?
Oh, what have I been up to during the last year? I had it was a busy year. I finished a trilogy, which ended with The Last Storyteller. And the three books in the trilogy were Venetia Kelly's Traveling Show, The Matchmaker of Kenmare, and The Last Storyteller. Now, when I was setting out to do it, I didn't really know that I was doing a trilogy, but I found when I had finished it that it had occupied a huge amount of my mind for quite a long time.
Oh.
And, of course, then the cupboard was bare. So I've been really recharging. I'm writing a young adult book at the moment, which I'll deliver to my agent next week.
Mm.
And I'm halfway through another novel, which I will deliver sometime in June or July. And that's basically what I've been doing. I've been regenerating and changing direction at the same time. I've been concentrating on books written in and about Ireland and focusing on Ireland for the last, 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm beginning to broaden my scope a little. I want to write something based in America or about Americans. I want to go more international than I have been doing for some time, simply because it's time to widen my horizons.
Right. So the new novel that you're working on is not based in Ireland, not set in Ireland?
The big novel is based, in fact, they're both based in Ireland, but one is about, the young adult one is about President Kennedy's visit in 1963.
Oh, really?
And the big one is set in Ireland in the 1870s, but it's got an English protagonist, a young Jesuit priest who goes to Ireland to solve a series of extraordinary events. He's been asked by a friend to come over, and it's dressed in a sense almost like a thriller, if you know what I mean. But it's not. It goes beyond that as well to raise extremely serious questions about the difference between belief and fact, whether you can believe in what you can't see.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And so it goes into territories of mystic and religious faith and things like that. And it's hugely enjoyable to write. So I've come to the conclusion that it's all I'm fit for. There's nothing else I can do.
It's okay. It's worthwhile, believe me. It's a life well lived. That's interesting you said that you lived, and I would imagine that you would, that a huge amount of your mind is occupied with the characters, with the story that you're writing about, and you wrote in it with a trilogy. That's a long period of time, Frank, that you're living in your mind, right?
It's just under 500,000 words.
Ooh.
Those books are around 150,000 words, 160,000 words each. And the characters are very, very engrossing and were very engrossing to me. And what is fascinating to me, and other writers had told me this in the past, but I kind of didn't believe them until I experienced it myself, all these characters were, in a sense, if you like, waiting to be written about. And they were just waiting for that particular turn on stage that they would do next. And therefore, when the end of the story is told, as it is in the very last pages of the third book, The Last Storyteller, and these, by the way, are novels that can stand alone, absolutely, one by one. They don't have to be read as a trilogy. As a trilogy, they fit together, I hope, the way you'd assemble a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Click, click, click. But when the story is told at the very, very end, when that story was told by the children of two of the characters at the end of The Last Storyteller, I found I was completely and utterly exhausted, and I didn't know it. I had no idea. And it, in a sense, it felt as if there was nothing else left in my mind. What's gratifying is the response from people who pick up, who have picked up the size and scope of the trilogy. I've just heard from somebody who read by accident, total stranger, by accident, read all three books in sequence. And kind of halfway through the first book, got it and realized, I wonder if the next two books have anything to do with this one. Farther they were, went out, bought the other two, and read all three over a weekend. And completely got it.
Oh, wonderful.
And then, you see, only one person. You only need one person, Kathleen. That's all you need.
Right.
That's the other half of the bargain. I'm 50% of the job. That reader is the other 50%.
Oh, I like that. Tom, who's evidently on I-94 somewhere. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks so much for this program. It's wonderful. You don't get a chance to tune into a poetry program very often, and having Mr. Delaney on is really great. I wanted to ask two things. One is, if you are writing poetry, what do either of you suggest in terms of submitting it to anyone so that, you know, it could be published? I write poetry, but I'm not so sure it's publishable, but a lot of other people seem to think it should be. So that's question number one. The second is, you know, after I read Stephen Dunn or those, I think to myself, holy God, I don't know what I'm doing. The other question I had is there a text or an approach to take to that would be helpful in writing even better poetry that either of you are aware of?
Those are two great questions and easy questions to answer, oddly enough. First thing is this. Here's the first point to remember about writing poetry. Writing poetry is, in the beginning, an embarrassment to oneself. The first feeling you feel is embarrassment. You say to yourself, who am I that I think I can write poetry? Once you get over that, you are completely validated. What you're doing is wonderful. No matter what anybody thinks of it, it's wonderful. It is your expression of your own spirit. And here's the kicker on that point, Tom and Kathleen. Here's the kicker. Think of how often we use poetry. We use it at weddings. We use it at funerals. We use all kinds of verses on all kinds of greeting cards. We use it to copper fasten our own thoughts. Why shouldn't we write our own verse? And remember, what anybody thinks of you or your writing, that's their problem, not yours. Secondly, so therefore, keep doing it. Secondly, the way to, and you can get it published, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of poetry sites on the internet who will publish it for you, and there are dozens and dozens of small magazines who publish poems, and it's well worth looking them up. Secondly, as to improve how you write, there's one surefire way of doing that, and there's a second supplementary one, which is also useful. First, read everybody you can. Find the poets you like. Find out why you like them. I, for example, have a great passion for the American poet Longfellow, who was a rock star in his day. And I have a great passion for him because his poems were popular in school.
Yes.
Often I think of the beautiful town that is seated by the sea, often in thought go up and down the pleasant streets of that dear old town, and my youth comes back to me. And the verse of a Lapland song is haunting my memory still. A boy's will is the wind's will, and the thoughts of youth are long, long thoughts. And I'm going to go to Portland, Maine, to see the town that he wrote about, to see those streets. Because of Longfellow.
Yes.
Find the poets you like. Don't imitate them. Read them. Read them aloud. Reading aloud is very important. Look at their rhythms. Look at where they break the story. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. Now listen to the next verse, because the third line in that first verse ends in the word here. The rhyming structure of the second verse picks up the word here. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. Between the woods and frozen lake, the coldest evening of the year. Look at the word lake. Because that becomes the rhyming structure of the third verse.
Oh.
He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sound's the sweep of Danu, wind, and billowy flake. There's the word sweep, and that's the rhyming structure of the last verse. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep. What could be simpler than that poem? What could be more difficult to write than that poem? But once you find a great poet like Frost writing a poem as powerful as that, that's as simple as that, that should encourage everyone who wants to write poetry. So all I say is, go thou and do likewise.
And what is it about that particular poem? There are many, certainly, Frank, but we almost all know that poem. We all know that poem, and we most people love that poem, and it lives and lives and lives. Why is that?
Several years ago, I wrote a novella that got published called My Dark Rosaline, and in the writing of it, Kathleen, I had a character, a policeman, whom I had to take out completely because it would have made it too long. The novella needed to be under 30,000 words in length, and it would have made it too long. But his force, his spirit, is still in the story to such a degree that somebody said to me one day, I love the policeman in that story. There is no policeman in that story. There's a force of spirit that is invested in the poem by Robert Frost. He was at his wit's end when he wrote that poem. His farm was failing through bad farming practices. He had no money. His kids were going crazy, some of them literally. And therefore, the power of his spirit is somewhere in there. And by the strange mental radio telepathy that we all call communication, we pick it up. Mm. And the woods gave him just a moment of tranquility. And yet at the end, having enjoyed his moment of tranquility, he thinks, I have serious challenges facing me.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Yeats for a moment, and I'd like for you to, if you have that book in front of you, to read me some Yeats. Why does he stand so tall, Frank?
Oh, because he was a giant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the short answer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a giant. There's no doubt about that. He had a capacity to... I did an interview many, many years ago with Seamus Heaney very, very early on.
Mm.
And we were talking about a lovely, a minor Irish poet who was killed in World War I called... Francis Ledwidge. And I said to Seamus Heaney, who was just a young poet at that particular time and just getting known, I said, what's the difference between Yeats, for example, and Ledwidge? He said, well, he said, Ledwidge, he said, surfed an interesting tide of poetry, he said. But Yeats started the tide.
Hmm.
And that was it. The poem of Yeats that keeps, with so many poems of Yeats, snatches keep coming back to me all the time. The one I was quoting earlier, O'Driscoll drove with a song, the wild duck and the drake from the mm-hmm. tall and the tufted reeds of the drear heart lake. And he saw how the reeds grew dark at the coming of night tide. And he dreamed of the long dim hair of Bridget his bride. And he heard as he sang and he dreamed a piper piping away. And never was piping so sad. And never was piping so gay. That's a song called The Hosts of the Air. And it's about the prevalence of myth and mysticism in our lives. The other one that comes to me is Red Hanrahan's song about Ireland, which is a wonderful, the old brown thorn trees breaking through. And the Easter 1916 poem, which has been one of the formative poems in my life. Yeats was in England when the rising broke out in Easter 1916.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very disturbed by it. And he didn't know where he stood because he was an Irish Protestant and therefore completely, you know, opposed to the idea of anything that the Irish Catholic peasants would do by force to take over the country from his people, the English. He didn't know what to do, but he came around to the idea of a bloody rebellion. And then he wrote a poem, and I'll just read you the first verse.
Sure.
Called Easter 1916. I have met them at close of day, coming with vivid faces from counter or desk among grey 18th century houses. I have passed with a nod of the head, or polite meaningless words, or have lingered a while and said polite meaningless words, and thought, before I had done, of a mocking tale or a jibe to please a companion around the fire of the club, being certain that they and I but lived where motley is worn. All changed, changed utterly. A terrible beauty is born. He's talking about the change of his own position, and he has moved, he's moving from a place where he would condemn these people outright as he walked past them in the street with nothing to say to them. And suddenly he realizes that what they're doing has the potential in it for great glory.
Hmm.
And that's what a poet can do.
Yes, that's what a poet can do. Hmm. Frank Delaney is our guest. We're celebrating St. Patrick's Day a little early. And Frank's one of those people, you could spend 5 minutes explaining all that he is. He is an author. He's written a number of books, most recently a trilogy, The Last Storyteller, Venetia Kelly's traveling show. He's author of Tipperary, Ireland. Many of you are familiar with that book, The Matchmaker of Kenmare, Shannon, Simple Courage. He does a podcast that each week gives a five-minute essay on James Joyce's Ulysses. So if you've had problems with that book, Frank, the best teacher in the world, can guide you through that. He is a documentary maker. He spent 25 years with the BBC doing doing interviews with authors, 3,500 authors, makes documentaries, and, well, he's wonderful. So who better could you have as a guest every year? And we do, Frank Delaney, before St. Patrick's Day. Here's our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've spent some time talking about poetry. There may be some Irish poets that are particularly meaningful to you that you would like to praise. There may be some music. Our program this hour focusing, of course, on culture and humor as well. And so we welcome you to join us. If not, just listen. That's fine. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Delaney, the most eloquent man in the world, I love saying that, is our guest this hour. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You mentioned that you were writing about the Kennedys' visit in 1963 to Ireland. It is so hard to believe that it's been 50 years this November since the assassination. Isn't it astonishing?
Astonishing. It was, he came to Ireland in June 1963, the end of June 1963. He was there for four days. The television service in the country was brand new. And they rented in or hired in or borrowed in from everywhere they could in Europe, outside broadcast facilities, so that they could follow him everywhere. And that was fine, but not many people had television sets. So in actual fact, what happened was the old thing happened. All the people came out to see him. There was even a story at one stage that of the 3.3 million people who lived in the Irish Republic at that time, more than 2 million had seen him. Given some of the photographs of the crowds, I'm prepared to believe it. I was just 21. For me, he changed everything. Because he came into a country that was depressed, censored, closed up, nothing to say for itself, in poor condition, emotionally, morally, financially, every way you can think of. He came in and he showed us what possibility was. I can scarcely speak about President Kennedy without being in tears.
Oh, Frank.
He was a major, major force in my life.
Really?
Everything about my life changed. It took a while to change. But everything about the country, we saw possibility. And remember, he was one of our own.
Yes,
he said afterwards that these were the three happiest days of his life. He was one of our own. He showed us what the emigrant experience at its best could have been. If you had to leave your country, as his great-grandfathers had to do in the 1840s, look at what became of them. He was president of the United States.
Right.
In Ireland in those days, of course, the Catholic thing was important, but not to him. And I knew that too. And I knew that this transcended religion and all the other power systems that help to control and divide people. He was tall, not as tall as everybody thinks, by the way. He was only 6 feet tall. To me, he looked about 6'4". He was immensely glamorous. He was witty. He was learned. He was thoughtful. He was fun. And he was a major world leader. He was the leader of the free world, and he was in our little country,
yes,
where his forefathers came from.
Yes. And he was eloquent.
Oh, my goodness, he was wonderful. He made some wonderful speeches in Ireland, and he just meant so much to so many people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's quite a story, Frank. I'm glad I asked you about him. So the book about that is coming out this year?
It hasn't been sold yet. It's a young adult book. It's for...
Oh, okay.
It's for in a sense, I'm not aiming it at anybody. I'm aiming it because it's something I really passionately wanted to write. It's one of those books that doesn't matter to me, but doesn't get published. My agent will not want to hear me saying that. But it's a book I passionately wanted to write, and it's about his visit. There's a fantasy element to it. It's about a boy who meets him and who is captivated by him. And I just wanted to tell the story of the difference he made and the importance of Irish ancestry fundamentally in somebody like him.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you wrote it. Let's go to Mary in Janesville. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I think of calling you very often, but I haven't ever done it before. But when your guest read the poem, Robert Frost's poem, Frosty Night, I couldn't help but call. My husband, who died in 2010, was passionate about poetry, and poetry had to have rhyme and meter for him. And his favorite poet was Robert Frost, and he loved this poem, My Little Horse Must Think It Queer. Now, so he wrote a poet, seeing we're from Wisconsin, he wrote a parody of Frost's poem. He wanted people to know that it was written out of total respect for Frost's greatness. And this is how Dick Ramsdell's poem goes. I hoist a frosty one to Robert. Whose car this is, I do not know. Some keys are in it, though. I stand without a tavern near. My nagging thirst begins to grow. The neighbors there must think it queer to see me slip the car in gear. Then down the road and round the lake, my goal is frosty mugs of beer. The neighbors give their heads a shake, not sure if there is some mistake, but then they turn back to their sweep of grass. The Joneses make them rake. I'll soon find beer, both dark and deep, a promise that I'll always keep. And then I'll likely fall asleep. Then I'll likely fall asleep.
That's very, very sweet. There have been lots of parodies, but that's one of the best ones I've heard. That's very sweet.
Thank you very much. And I guess maybe it's an honor to have a parody written about a famous poem.
Oh, absolutely.
Like that,
and,
right?
And there's a sense of true homage about that poem, too.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Mary, very much for the call. Margot in River Falls. Hi.
Hi. I just want you to know today that I have such beautiful memories of my husband, who was solid Irish and Scottish a little bit, and his parents were Frank from Ireland. They used to entertain me for hours with their stories of Ireland. It was so gorgeous, and thank you today because you make me think of all of those wonderful days of listening to their stories. And thank you. Top of the morning to you.
Thanks, Margo. Thanks very much for your call. Do you find a need to return very often, Frank? And is it comfortable for you to be living, to have had a life in two countries?
Oh, I've had a life in more than two countries. I was just reflecting the other day.
Oh, that's right. England, too.
I was just reflecting the other day. I have 6 driving licenses.
Do you really? Where else?
Ireland, England, France, Italy, Germany, and the United States.
Oh, I didn't know about all those.
I don't use them all at once, I can tell you. But I think there's a sense in which I have a clearer view of my own country. Living abroad, it's kind of home thoughts from abroad. Distance lends enchantment to the view and all of that. And Ireland has gone through some profound changes in the last few years, changes it could never have contemplated in the past. And, you know, there's a real sense, Kathleen, in which I think the country has only just begun to grow up.
Hmm. What are those profound changes, Frank?
Well, they found themselves in horrendous financial difficulty.
Yeah.
I mean, really extraordinary difficulty. And they had to face up to it and begin to pay their debts. And that's exactly what they've been doing. And they've been doing it through programs of austerity. The big story, the really great story that has come out of Ireland, great in every sense, is the acknowledgement of past abuses. You may have seen a film called The Magdalene Sisters.
No, I have not.
It was about basically how certain orphanages were run in Ireland as sweatshops.
Oh, I've heard about this,
In which girls were taken in on any kind of pretext at all.
Yes.
A girl troublesome at home or a girl who got pregnant was in there for the rest of her life and lost her identity.
Mm.
And in the last year, the Prime Minister in Ireland, a man you would never expect to take this view at all, has publicly castigated the church authorities. And he is a devout Catholic himself, the church authorities, for all the abuses, both in the convents and the paedophile priest scandals, and insisted on apologies. He went head to head with the Vatican on this and demanded apologies from the Vatican. And he did it in public, and he did it in the House of Parliament. He made it legal. He made it official. And so many people were so moved by it and so thanked him for it. And it was a kind of growing up that you could never, ever have anticipated when I was a boy.
What has the whole abuse scandal done to the faithful in Ireland? I've read that very few people go to church now on Sundays. Right. It was such a part of identity. What happened as a result of this to that identity?
I did a survey many years ago in the late 70s of mass going in Ireland. In rural Ireland, it was 100% of the Catholic population.
Hmm.
In urban Ireland, it was about 98% of the Catholic population. I don't know what the numbers today are, but the last numbers I heard were down in the 20s and 30s.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's been a huge falling off. Well, here's the thumbnail sketch. The big seminary, Maynooth, which when my brother was the senior dean there, there were 668 clerical students there, students for the priesthood. That was in the mid-1970s. Last year, there were two.
Oh, my.
That's the change.
Wow. That's a very big change, and it's sort of hard to take all of that in. It's meaningful, I'm sure.
It's massive.
Yeah.
And those, I think both of those are from the Philippines somewhere.
Mm. Let's take one more phone call for Frank Delaney, and this is Frank from Milwaukee. Hi, Frank.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program very much. Always enjoy your programs. Mr. Delaney, I couldn't say this to the screener without choking up, but I want you to know that President Kennedy had the same effect on young people here. And I'm very heartened to hear that he had such a profound effect on your life, because I was a teacher in my career, and he had a profound effect on my life.
We're not going to be able to get through this conversation.
Yeah, well,
just,
the point is that...
Yeah.
I wish
you
could have returned in springtime.
Do you know why he had such a profound effect on you?
The call to public service, the eloquence, the concern for all levels of the population, among other things, civil rights.
He was unrivaled.
Were introduced under Kennedy, and because the only redeeming part of Kennedy's life in terms of his assassination was... Under his after he was killed, under Johnson's incredible leadership and invoking the name of Kennedy, all those wonderful laws got through, like voting rights, civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, etc.
What's not generally, there are two things about Kennedy that are not generally known, and I'm going to say them very quickly.
Yes.
Because we're almost out of time.
Thank you.
This was a man in horrendous poor health.
Mm-hmm.
He had osteoporosis when he was 30. This was a man kept alive by steroid injections. Two, this was a man who had only one major commitment in his life, and that was to public service. That was his great passion, was serving his country. And he wanted everybody to understand that serving your country was about the noblest calling there was, whatever the sleaze of politics, that serving your country was the noblest thing a human being could do.
Frank, thank you so much. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
The same to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our great pleasure. Frank Delaney, I would recommend that you just Google Frank Delaney, because if you go to his website, he does so many different things that you want to see the entirety of who he is. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, Katie Madsen for on-air production in Milwaukee.